Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks with you here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown. The Ocean City station is WYPO, serving the eastern shore of Maryland, and we're streaming live online through WYPR.org. We're all over the place. Thank you for listening and tuning in and making Midday part of your day. It's the end of the school year, and this was a particularly challenging school year between a rushed adjustment to the new Common Core standards and the rough winter that resulted in makeup days for many of the state's school districts. Also causing some strain on teachers is a newly implemented teacher evaluation formula in which student test scores are used, at least in part, to determine the effectiveness of each teacher and ultimately their pay. Liz Bowie, education reporter for the Baltimore Sun, will be joining us to discuss the controversy-laden school year just a little bit later in this hour. Up front, we take a look at some of the other controversies, national in scope. The Supreme Court of the United States wrapping up its term. A ruling yesterday, the Hobby Lobby ruling, in which corporations are allowed to opt out of providing certain contraceptives to employees that are covered under the Affordable Care Act. We're joined now by Mike Myerson, professor and faculty fellow at the University of Baltimore's School of Law, joining us again on Midday to unpack Supreme Court rulings. Nice to see you again, Professor Myerson.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And also joining us today is Dahlia Lithwick, I'm happy to say, contributing editor for Newsweek, as well as senior editor at Slate, who writes about the Supreme Court for Slate.com. Dahlia Lithwick, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with you because I enjoyed reading your post, Supreme Court breakfast table on Slate. For a hands-off court, you say, or at least the subhead says, for a hands-off court, this one sure is hands-on. Can you give us your take on this?
Well, I think that I was trying to understand, you know, really the big question about Hobby Lobby going forward is whether this was a great big deal or a little tiny deal. And depending on who you read in this case, if you read the majority opinion, it's a 5-4 opinion authored by Samuel Alito for the 5 conservative members of the court. He says, you know, this is a nothing to see here, no big deal. You know, this only extends to the contraception mandate. It's not going to go beyond that. It only is giving these religious conscience exemptions will only be for small, closely held family corporations, so move on, no worries. And then Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, writing for the 4 liberals in dissent, says, you know, the sky is falling, this is terrible, you know, today the Green family, owners of Hobby Lobby, tomorrow Jehovah's Witnesses denying blood transfusions, and how can you say it's only closely held corporations, it's going to be Exxon next. So really the fight here in the aftermath is how big a deal this case was, and what I was trying to say in my post was, if the court is taking the position which they take, which is we don't want to be in the business of arbitrating what is a real religion, what's not a real religion, what is a deeply felt religious conviction and what is feigned, we want to be out of that business, they kind of just put themselves in that business, because by saying the Green family is exempted, I think they do open the doors either to having to adjudicate for the rest of time which companies are going to have religion for the purposes of this statute, and which companies' religions are deeply felt. It seems as though the court is doing exactly what it doesn't want to do, which is wading in to a religious culture war.
Thank you, Dahlia. And Mike Myerson, it sounds like, just from our little chat before we got on the air, that you're sort of in the same place on this.
In a way. I mean, they're opening the door, but they're not walking through it, is what I see.
Not even a baby step.
Just as we just heard, they're creating the possibility that the court will have to get involved as more and more corporations claim the right to discriminate based on religion or sexual orientation or a lot of other things. But they were very, very careful. And actually, I think there was a third opinion that really counts to me, and that's Justice Kennedy, the fifth vote, who sometimes votes conservative, and his whole opinion was, don't read the majority too much. And you get a sense, at least I got the sense, that Justice Alito had a right back, pull back from walking through the door. So we now know that some private corporations have some religious rights, but how much, we really don't know.
The phrase closely held would probably be appreciated by our audience to talk about that. This applies specifically to closely held corporations. Dahlia, you just mentioned family-owned corporations. What is a closely held corporation?
The court doesn't define it, of course.
Thanks a lot.
They promise it's not Exxon, though whether we believe it or not, well, I'm not sure. See, I always had a trouble because corporations are what they called a legal fiction. They don't exist. And in fact, the only reason for corporations is to separate the person who owns it from all liability. So it's a separation of person from business. And now we're being told that a business can pray, if you will. And the court says that's only because you have a family-owned corporation. So the corporation doesn't get in the way of the people. But they swear, the court does, that this will not apply to a large company like Exxon.
So they swear it will. Where's the guarantee in that? I guess that's what Dahlia Lithwick is saying here. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg, is saying that the court has ventured into a minefield and saying that they have opened a door here.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the line could have easily been drawn between religious organization on the one hand and for-profit corporations on the other. It would have been a clean line, but they decided they didn't want to draw it. They decided essentially that Hobby Lobby, even with lots of employees, looks like a mom-and-pop store. And mom and pop have the right.
Even with some, what, Dahlia Lithwick, 13,000 employees at least.
I've heard between 13 and 16,000, right. But certainly 500 stores across the nation. And it's worth saying, it almost isn't worth saying because it's so obvious, but most of those employees, you know, there's no way to know whether those employees share the religious values of the Green family. You know, right. This is not like the Little Sisters or the cases in the not-for-profits where you have, you know, a Catholic organization that's a not-for-profit where they can say, look, we have an explicitly religious mission and the Little Sisters who work for us share our religion. Here you have these third parties, right, all the women who work for Hobby Lobby who've been given a statutory right, an entitlement to have their contraception covered, and they're being told, regardless of your faith, that doesn't come into play here because the Green family gets a trump. And that's one of the things that's really complicated about this case is that the rights of those third parties completely don't appear in the majority opinion. And, you know, they sort of fall out of the case altogether.
So the corporations, we mentioned Hobby Lobby, another one, Conestoga Wood Specialties of Pennsylvania, argued that the ACA, or Obamacare, violates the First Amendment and other federal laws protecting religious freedom because it requires them to provide coverage for contraceptives and such as the morning after pill. I guess that's the one that they focused on, which the companies consider a morning after pill tantamount to abortion. Is that it?
Yeah, there are, in these cases, there are four of the 20 contraceptive methods and devices that are approved by the FDA and then become, you know, part of the ACA contraception package. Four of them are objected to by these owners. Two are Ella and Plan B, which are, you know, variations of the morning after pill. The other two are actually more controversial. They're IUDs, two forms of intrauterine devices. And the reason that's complicated is because, A, they're extremely expensive. It can cost $1,000 to get one inserted. And, B, in a lot of cases that have nothing to do with contraception or preventing pregnancy but simply the health of women, the IUD is actually the first thing that doctors reach for. And so this case kind of sprawls beyond merely regulating contraception or abortifacients, you know, drugs that cause abortions, and starts to really get into second-guessing physicians in cases that have nothing to do with that when they want to prescribe something that's best for a woman's health.
Mike Meyerson.
Just want to add one small point. The stores all made these very broad claims that the Obamacare violated the First Amendment to the Constitution, which guarantees free exercise of religion. The court said that's not the right question because Congress passed another law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was the basis of this. So this is not, interestingly enough, about constitutional rights. Mm. It's about a law Congress passed in the 1990s basically saying that when the federal government interferes with religion, it can only do so if it has what they call a compelling interest and no other way to accomplish their goal. So this is a statute, not the Constitution.
An important question here. Didn't the Obama administration work out a workaround around this mandate or this requirement last year or the year before when there was political pressure to do so.
Yes, the Obama administration created this system whereby religious organizations, purely religious organizations, could comply with the law by simply punting it to their insurance companies who would take over. And that actually was the heart and soul of Justice Kennedy, if not Justice Alito's opinion, that there was an easy alternative. So you didn't have to force the Green family to do what violated their religious conscience.
Here's a question from one of our listeners, Frank in Hampstead. He says, Hobby Lobby contended that life begins at conception and that birth control methods prevent implementation of the implantation of the fertilized egg in the womb and that that's abortion. Science says that life does not necessarily begin at conception. So why would the Supreme Court give preference to a belief over science? Dahlia Lithwick.
That's one of the tricky wickets here. I mean, there are two problems. One is that the court defers completely to the religious objectors in this case in terms of how deeply felt their faith is. They say we're not going to get into the question of scrutinizing how religious you are, whether you mean it. So that's one piece of it. And as a part of that, they also defer to the religious group's science. In other words, there is nothing in the opinion, no discussion or debate about why, you know, these are FDA-approved drugs. The medical consensus is that clearly none of these are abortion-causing drugs. None of that makes its way into this dispute. Justice Alito has a line saying, you know, we're not going to get into that. So I think that there is this problem of we concede as a court, says Alito, that the religious conviction is what they say it is, and we concede that the science is, for purposes of this discussion, what they say it is. And that's once you've kind of taken that position, it really raises questions. I mean, not just the question that you asked about, you know, how can we be in conflict with science, but what does the court do with, like, deeply held religious convictions that, you know, the world is only a few hundred years old, or deeply held religious convictions that nobody should get antidepressants under a religion. So I think, again, it throws open the door to saying if we're really not going to question people's science as a part of not questioning their religious conviction, it puts the court in a position of having to either accede to all these religious objections or start picking and choosing whose science is right and whose religious convictions are normal.
I have to say, I have to sympathize with Justice Alito and the majority on this particular issue. I really don't want my court telling me whether my faith is right or not. I don't want to have to defend my practice, and I think that's valid. So the fact that they truly believed that these contraception devices violated their religious faith, that's enough. Whether or not they can prove it would have the court making everyone prove their faith, and it's called faith for a reason.
Right.
And so I am actually very glad the court is not in the prove your faith business.
A question or comment from email Bradley, one of our listeners. It seems corporations are now getting the same rights as citizens. I believe this to be illogical. An accounting entity is not a person, is it? Comments, please.
Well, certainly this is a stretch. In a lot of the campaign finance laws, corporations are given the right to contribute. But the court has always said it's not that corporations are people, as Romney said. It's the fact that speech is a public good. And the more speech, the better for a democratic society. I can accept that. This is different. This is indeed a stretch because the conversation in religion is between the individual and God. And the government has no interest in facilitating that or making that easier, if you will. And so I think adding corporations to the adding religion to corporations' speech rights is indeed a stretch.
And I would just, I think, add that, you know, certainly I think people have less of a problem with the idea that nonprofit corporations, you know, that churches and Catholic universities and hospitals can exercise religion. I think the other stretch in this case is extending that forward to Hobby Lobby, which sells scrapbooks, right, and stencils. And it really does raise a question about how Hobby Lobby, not the Green family, but this corporation that is a for-profit corporation that really only at the margins has a, you know, they're closed on Sunday and they play Christian music in the stores, but only at the margins can they say that they are, as a corporation, exercising religion. And so I think the stretch is also to say that this for-profit corporation is somehow the same as a Catholic hospital, you know, that they are exercising religion in the same way.
Here's a comment on Facebook from John, who says, it is such a shame. I think he's being a little sarcastic here. He says, they are forced to work for Hobby Lobby, meaning the employees. Then Hobby Lobby won't buy their birth control. Can they choose to work somewhere else? Can they choose to buy their own birth control? It does get to the question of, in the real world, what's the real world effect of this in terms of the medical coverage for women who might be employed by Hobby Lobby or this other company?
Well, there's something in that question that I think is really an important point, which is the freedom of workers. I know a whole lot of people who'd be happy to find any given job. We don't have the kind of job market where everyone has the freedom to pick and choose. One of the reasons for this uniform law was because of the weakness of individual workers. You see this in places like Walmart. So I am not at all as blasé as the snarky comment of, oh, just get another job. It simply doesn't work that way in the real world.
And I think that the question also elides the truth of, you know, there were extensive findings made that showed that women who don't have access to contraception are severely disadvantaged. They pay so much more of their income toward birth control. If they don't have, and I explain why, in some cases, medically necessary and expensive forms of birth control. This isn't just about go to the drugstore and get a condom. There are many, many reasons that 99% of American women use birth control, about half of which have to do with preventing pregnancy. But I think that to suggest that, oh, you know, A, this is, doesn't disadvantage women specifically as a group, that the idea that their choices about reproductive care, when they're going to have children, how they're going to have children, if they are in medical danger from having a pregnancy that was unexpected. There's a whole panoply of reasons that it's not just a matter of strolling across the street, getting another job, or strolling down the street and buying condoms. There are medically necessary reasons that the Obama administration and HHS determined that contraception was part of basic preventive care, and part of the argument was because this is really crucial for women to have equality in the workplace.
So what's likely to happen there in terms of administrative fix, congressional fix for any gap in medical coverage here?
I can't imagine there ever being a congressional fix.
Yeah.
Not until redistricting in 2020.
Yeah,
the administrative fix, though, I think you say, is actually the more likely approach, which is simply extend the workaround that they created a year or two ago. Because remember, this whole issue is from the regulations passed by HHS after Obamacare was passed. So this is not a legislative battle. It's actually all regulatory, which means, bottom line, the Obama administration can fix it themselves.
Michael Meyerson is professor and faculty fellow at the University of Baltimore School of Law. We thank you for being here again today, Michael, to talk about the Supreme Court. Michael Meyerson has joined us here on Midday in the Past. And Dahlia Lithwick, nice to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making time for us.
It's my pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick, contributing editor for Newsweek, senior editor at Slate. She writes about the Supreme Court. Supreme Court Dispatches is her column. You can find a link to her comments on this Supreme Court ruling on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. We're going to take a break here. And when we get back, Liz Bowie, education reporter of the Baltimore Sun, will be joining us to talk about education issues as the school year closes out, including the idea of, or the debate over, including student test scores in the evaluation of teachers to determine their pay. We'll be talking about that after this short break. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. The email address for Midday is midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. Well, summer break is underway. Of course, summer vacation for the school kids. So we're going to take a look at the past academic year, which has had some challenges. The transition to Common Core standards, the harsh winter, a lot of snow. And the snow caused many school districts to tack on some makeup days at the end of the year. And students and educators alike, we're all looking forward to the end. Finally is here. Liz Bowie of the Baltimore Sun, my colleague, has been covering education for several years for the newspaper, and she's joining us here in the studio. Liz, nice to have you with us again.
Nice to be back.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about your Sunday story about this new formula for teacher evaluations, including student test scores and teacher evaluations. But before we get to that, just want to look back at the past year a little bit here and the things that I mentioned. First of all, the weather did make it for a longer school year almost every place around here, right?
Everywhere, yes. And it was something that nobody really wanted, particularly in school systems where there's not air conditioning in every school. So I think that teachers really like that first, and students really love that first snow day of the winter.
Yeah.
But when you get to your 14th, it's not quite as much fun.
Teachers were also wrestling with Common Core. You know, I referred to Common Core as a new curriculum in a recent column. I just made a passing reference to it as a new curriculum. And a teacher wrote to me saying it's not a new curriculum. It's a set of standards. I see you use the term controversial new curriculum for Common Core. But it is curriculum, right? It's a change in curriculum.
It is new standards. So there are new standards that were adopted by 40-some states. Some are backing away from it now, so I don't have the exact number, but 44 originally.
Right.
Each of those states adopted the standards which say, here's what you have to know by the end of each grade in math and reading. Then each state takes, or each school system takes those standards and writes their own curriculum. So there is a Common Core curriculum that flows out of this statewide or standards.
Okay. Thus the use of the term curriculum. I understand. And this year was a little bit tricky. This is a tricky year in Maryland because, let me see if I get this right. This was the last year teaching the old way, they were teaching the new way with the old test. Am I right? With the old tests.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So what happened was that a lot of these reforms that came in several years ago are now, everything's happening at once. So you have new teacher evaluations, you have new curriculum, you have new tests next year. And this year we had the old tests, but we field tested the new tests, so you had sort of these lots and lots of days of testing going on, although we didn't double test. But it was just a crazy, crazy year. And one of these reforms would have been enough, but we had several on top of one another. And so that's what made it a hard year, I think, for teachers and administrators. And I'm not sure that how much kids noticed, but but I know that it was difficult.
I was going to ask you that. How much would students have noticed in the classroom?
I think they noticed that there. Well, I went to an elementary school, and nobody really noticed at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are differences. There are definitely differences in what kids are learning. And I think there were some students probably in higher grades in 5th, 6th, 7th grade who could say, yeah, there was a difference in what I was learning. It was different, and you know, I had to analyze more. I had to do more writing. I had to do more analysis. I had to figure out how to do math in a different way.
Right. Now, you use the word controversial. Everyone seems to use controversial with the term Common Core.
Right.
It may be controversial, but it is here. It's in place in Maryland, and teachers will be teaching this to these new standards and new curriculum this fall. Right.
Yes.
All right.
Definitely.
So it's not
I don't think in Maryland it's going away for a very long time. I think there is broad-based support for it among both the teaching core and the state leadership.
You had an interesting story about the end of the school year a couple of weeks ago in The Sun and quoted a principal in Anne Arundel County.
Yes.
Susan Ericciello.
Right.
43 years in education, so she's retiring. She was the principal at Belvedere Elementary School in Anne Arundel County, so a good person to talk to, lots of perspective on that. And she felt that that some of the changes that came down were stupid and not well thought out. Was she referring to some of the Common Core stuff?
I think there has been some concern that things were rushed through, changes were rushed through. And mm-hmm. so whenever you do something in a rush, it's not always goes perfectly.
Right. It seemed like it came on all of a sudden, although they had been brewing for many years and formulating these new standards. And teachers took summer classes to get ready for it, right?
Some teachers did. The state did some pretty big training sessions for several years in a row, but not every teacher in every school went. So it's a big learning curve. And I think, you know, everybody agrees it was a pretty short time frame to do this major kind of.
Are there classes for teachers this summer as well?
Yes.
For Common Core?
Yes.
Okay. Liz Bowie is our guest, education reporter of the Baltimore Sun. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Here's a question I posed based on Liz's story on Sunday, which I found really interesting. Should what we pay a teacher be based on his or her students' test scores, at least in part? It's not totally based on that. This has to do with a new formula for evaluating teacher performance. So I wanted to talk about this with you because I think this is really interesting. First of all, Liz Bowie, how were teachers evaluated now or in the past versus this new formula that's coming into place?
So in the past, your principal went in and did formal evaluations of you. They looked at, are you helping out with coaching soccer in the afternoon? What are you helping out leading something in terms of the faculty? What, you know, how is your classroom behavior, demeanor? Are you organized? Do your lesson plans make sense? But they didn't look at, you know, do your students achieve? Are your students on grade level? How successful were you in taking your kids from beginning of second grade to end of second grade? Did they learn a year's worth of stuff?
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. Now, that's sort of a subjective assessment by the school administrator.
Exactly.
Mr. Murray, where I was, came from. He would sit in the classroom. We wondered what he was doing in there.
Right.
So he was probably evaluating Miss Venturini, right?
Right.
In fourth grade.
Right.
So this goes way back. This has been done for years.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So, and it's kind of, does it seem kind of incredible, actually, when you step back from it for a minute to say they didn't include student achievement in the teacher evaluation?
It does, in a way. I mean, it does sort of. On the other hand, they've been doing it for decades. I think what critics said was, look, we're doing it this way. If it's so effective, why are 1% of teachers who are evaluated every year or 2% ever found to be ineffective?
Mm-hmm. You mean why is that percentage so low?
Right.
Okay, when you compare that with student achievement, okay, so they
look. So how, if you're so effective, how can every kid in your school be failing the assessment?
Okay, so the new formula, which isn't quite in place in Maryland yet.
No,
right?
It is. Well, it's sort of. It's sort of, yeah.
Your story said that they're going to actually be using it in a couple of years, right?
So everything has been put in place except the use of test scores, which has been delayed for several years.
Okay.
2 years.
All right, well, let's talk about that. So let's talk about the controversy here.
So around the nation, everybody started saying, whoa, they thought it was a great idea to have test scores used to evaluate teachers. But then when they got down to the actual details, what they realized is that you were going to be using test scores on an old test to evaluate how a teacher was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm supposed to be teaching material that says A, and my kids are going to be tested on the material that was B, which makes no sense at all.
Right.
The other thing is you need 2 years of data from the new test in order to judge what progress students made. So you see how they tested at the end of second grade and then the end of third grade, and you take that growth over that year and you can come up with some formula that evaluates how the teacher did in terms of the student achievement. But you can't do it with 1 year of data. So that left them with 3 years down the road.
I get you.
And so across the nation, there's been kind of a backlash, including in Maryland, kind of a backlash that says, hey, we really can't put this test score stuff in place until 2016, 2017.
Okay, that part I understand. But there isn't a general backlash against the whole idea of including test scores in the formula, because it's not all of it, but it's a percentage of the formula. Right?
And what percentage that is a great deal of debate right now. Maryland will have to use, they're saying that you have to look at your kids' test scores. So the principal has to look at a teacher's test scores from the last year and say, wow, you know, that's a math teacher who's teaching fractions, and her kids can do math, but they can't ever do fractions. So part of her objective over the coming year will be to improve how many kids learn fractions. So what they're saying is that the objectives, even next year and the year after, should include test scores to inform what the goals for that teacher are. So okay, technically, they're somewhat in, the test scores are supposed to be somehow intrinsically involved in their evaluation.
So the state has a pilot evaluation program going.
Well, it's over now.
It's over now. So what did you find? Because I know you did a public records check.
Right.
What did you see in the school systems in our area?
Everything but Baltimore City made no sense at all. Basically, because they did it such a limited pilot, and they selected their best teachers, so it really didn't prove much of anything.
They selected their best teachers to evaluate?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, you know.
So it wasn't a general evaluation of every teacher.
No.
Okay.
So only in Baltimore City did they do an evaluation for every teacher. And they did use test scores. And under that pilot evaluation, which was probably a pretty valid pilot, they got 10.8% ineffective and about 10% highly effective. And everybody else was in the middle.
80% in the middle there.
Yeah.
What is the complaint of school teachers in Baltimore City about the evaluations? They had a demonstration a couple of weeks ago at the end of the school year. What are they complaining about?
Well, they say that they changed the that in order to be rated highly effective, you had to have a score of 80, or that was what they thought, and that the school system changed that number to 86 in the last few weeks and didn't tell anybody. But
do you know why they did that?
No, I don't.
The suggestion is, or the accusation from the school teachers is that they did that so they wouldn't have to give as much merit pay out to teachers?
Right, exactly.
Okay. So let's talk about merit pay for a minute. Then we're going to take a break. I want to ask that question of our listeners again about this connection between test scores, teacher evaluations, and pay. So, Liz, please help me understand. I know in Baltimore City there is a merit pay system.
It's
right?
The only system that I'm aware of in Maryland that has a true merit system now.
You answered my question. Okay. Because I wondered, this question about pay, where does this have a bearing in Baltimore City?
Yes. Although one, you know, many people look down the road and think it's coming, you know, eventually other school systems, if it works in the places where it's being tried, right, that eventually other school systems would have the same system.
So you'd provide some incentive. For teachers as well to perform, get their kids to perform better.
Right.
Okay. We're going to take a break here. Please phone in if you have comments or questions for Liz Bowie, education reporter of the Baltimore Sun, my colleague from Calvert Street. I just want to say one last thing. The kids who studied all year a certain curriculum and then went back to the old test, which they hadn't studied for, that's like a nightmare to me. Isn't that the classic dream nightmare that people have? You study and study, and then you get to, you can't find the classroom where they're giving the test, so you panic and you get there, and you find out they're giving the wrong test.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't know that question.
Those poor kids. But you went to classrooms and the kids did okay.
I don't think the teachers were worried about
All right. It just sounded, on the surface, traumatic to me. This is Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Liz Bowie. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Have a question about public education in Maryland, specifically about teacher evaluations, please give us a ring. You can send a question by email, too, if you're near a computer or smartphone, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Liz Bowie, education reporter for the Baltimore Sun. How is the city resolving this complaint from the teachers union, the teachers in Baltimore City, about the change in the evaluation formula?
Well, I'm not sure what's going to happen because today, of course, we have a new CEO in Baltimore. Greg Thornton started that just this morning.
It's July 1st, isn't it?
It is. So I think we have to see what he decides he wants to do with it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a call for Liz Bowie. 410-662-8780, especially if you're a teacher. How do you feel about this? Or you can tell us what the past year was like in adjusting to Common Core. There are 60,000 teachers in Maryland, some of them probably listening today to Midday. Feel free to give us a ring. Brian in Baltimore, welcome to the show.
Dan. Yeah.
Hi. Good. Go right ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to comment. I was working in the city school system as a mental health counselor, not as a teacher. But it just seems to me that there are so many things that can, you know, affect student grades aside from their current teacher's effectiveness, you know, previous teacher's effectiveness or home life. I mean, a lot of the kids I was working with had serious, you know, mental health issues and, you know, environmental stressors that it just seems like if teachers are going to be evaluated by, you know, how affected by their students' test scores, it just shouldn't be taken that much into account. There are so many other things that can affect the student's performance.
Hmm. So how do you arrive upon a percentage? What percentage of the total evaluation process or formula should be given over to the actual test scores of students? How do you arrive at that? I guess that's a rhetorical question. I don't know, Brian, if you have a guess on that. Should it be 50%? It sounds to me like you think it should be a pretty small amount.
I do. I mean, if this is something that's just being, you know, changed now, everything seems to be going okay before. I mean, you can't suddenly say, well, now it's going to be like a huge chunk of your evaluation is how good your students do on these test scores.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Brian. I don't know if you have a comment about that, Liz. How are they deciding on this formula? It still hasn't been decided?
There are a number of different formulas that are used throughout the nation, and there are a lot of, actually, economists who are working on trying to create a formula. They're called VAMS, for short. Value-added measures, and they're basically mathematical formulas. And some of them take into account a lot of different factors, including whether a student arrived in that classroom halfway through the school year, or you know whether the students are from poverty, or a lot of other factors.
Hmm. Does the principal or assistant principal still sit in the back of the classroom for part of this evaluation?
For 50% of the evaluation.
50% of it. Okay. Megan in Baltimore, you're on Midday Next with Liz Bowie. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me.
Go right ahead, please.
So the evaluation system in Baltimore is actually a lot more broken than people think it is. Not only because of the union's current complaints, but also because principals are rewarded when they do not complete evaluations for their teachers. By that, I mean if an evaluation is not completed for a teacher, that teacher is automatically rated as an effective teacher, which basically means that they receive 9 achievement units, which in Baltimore City, you have to receive 12 in order to get your pay raise. So automatically, if a teacher is not rated for some reason, if their evaluations aren't completed, then the entire staff of teachers who do not get rated end up getting an effective, and then the city and the principal do not have to pay out pay raises for the next year. So I think it's something that the city is really not considering, especially because in the city you can grieve anything below an effective rating, but if you receive a rating of effective, you cannot grieve that because you're automatically getting 9 AUs. So I guess in the union's book that's being considered generous.
Megan, are you a teacher?
I am a teacher.
It sounds like you have some insight here. Did this happen in the school where you're a teacher?
I've heard it from multiple friends at various schools where their principal could not stay or anything like that that may have happened. I've heard it from several different teachers when I go to professional developments that their principal left the school and then they couldn't complete the evaluation. So then,
they were just given an effective score?
Exactly.
And
yeah.
An effective doesn't get you a pay raise?
Exactly.
What's wrong with effective? I like effective. I think you have to be highly effective in order to receive a pay raise?
Well, consider
merit raise?
The fact that, yeah, you have to be considered highly effective. And consider the teachers who would normally get highly effective are considered automatically effective. You're talking about model teachers or teachers who really do deserve a highly effective, teachers who are working their tails off to get that rating. There are a few of my friends received highly effective in the prior school year, and then in this current school year, they were rated effective just because their observations were not completed.
Well, thank you very much, Megan. Have you heard anything like that?
No, I haven't. That's pretty interesting.
Thank you, Megan. Tom and Frederick, thank you for calling Midday. Go right ahead with your comments.
So I was going to add to the conversation some things that were already brought up while I was on hold, but when it comes to evaluating teachers based off of student test grades, there's so many factors that come into play that teachers have no control over. Some of the things that were mentioned are, is the child in poverty? Do they come from a single-family household? How much mobility have they had from school to school in the current school year? There's also simple things like how much sleep did they get the night before? Did they eat breakfast? Sometimes these tests are culturally insensitive to English to children that speak Spanish and other cultures. It's just so many things that play into the test score. To hold teachers 100% accountable for student achievement just isn't fair. And then also to base teacher pay off of that or teacher job security, it just seems like it's not addressing the true problem in education, which is probably addressing poverty.
Thank you very much for your comments. I mean, if you can put yourselves in the shoes of a teacher for a moment and think about the whole process of trying to, you know, organize a school year, a calendar, a plan for your classes, no matter what grade you teach, and then actually dealing with children from day to day and trying to teach them. How daunting that is alone. And then to think about your evaluation is going to be based on how they do on a test, or maybe a considerable percentage of the evaluation, maybe up to 50%.
No,
you don't think it'll be that high?
I think that it may be. I mean, it depends on the local school system.
And right.
I think Maryland is headed towards saying it should be a significant portion. I think for student growth, and that could be test scores and something else.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the thought is it would be more like 20%.
Okay. Well, where is the describe something comparable in the private sector. That's what I was getting at. I mean, a lot of people who work have evaluations, employee evaluations that may be tied to merit pay in some cases. That may sound very familiar to some people. But I don't know if you can... I'm trying to think of an example where there's scores involved, right? Results, sales, for instance.
That's, sales, yeah.
Well, sales, yeah. How'd you do in sales versus how'd you do teaching children fractions, right? And how did they do on a test? That, to me, that's a completely different and more complex transaction than,
how many
selling
cars did you sell
cars.
Today?
Yeah. Abby and Towson, go right ahead. Welcome to Midday, Abby.
Hi, longtime listener. Thanks for taking my call.
Great.
My question is about what amount of accountability the students are going to have. And I'll tell you a brief story, which was when I was in high school not that long ago. We would have these testing days. They would sit everybody down in the cafeteria or something like that, and they would tell us, this is not going to reflect on your grade in this course, you know, and this is just to evaluate the teachers. So people would take a nap. They would make a smiley face out of the bubble sheet. If they didn't like the teacher, they would intentionally, you know, do poorly. So what accountability do the students have? And then is it if they do have some accountability for what their test scores are, is that fair?
In some cases, there will be a lot of accountability because for high school students, they can't graduate from high school without doing well on these tests. So for them, I think it makes a good deal of difference.
Mm-hmm.
For the elementary grades and the middle school, I guess there isn't. I think that there is a good deal of, will probably be a good deal of pressure put on students to do well. I think they'll be encouraged to do their best.
Matthew writes in to say, how does tying teacher pay to test scores give any incentive or benefit to those teachers whose students aren't tested? As a Maryland music teacher, Does this exempt me from pay raises or leave me open to disdain from teachers who are dependent on those scores?
So there are only 20% of Maryland teachers who are teaching in quote, tested areas in where there are standardized tests.
Really? Out of 60,000 teachers?
Yeah, 20%, about maybe 25%. And the remainder of those teachers, there will be some tests included in their evaluation. So, for instance, if you're a teaching advanced placement, your advanced placements, your kids' advanced placement scores could be used. Or if you're teaching, but there are a lot of teachers for whom they'll just be student learning objectives or these growth measures that will be kind of decided on between the principal and the teacher, or the, you know, grade level and of teachers and the principal at the beginning of the year. And there'll be a beginning of the year test given and an end of the year test given.
By the way, Liz, you reported in the story on Sunday that teacher evaluation formula, the new system for teacher evaluation, is the latest education battleground, not just in Maryland, but across the country. District of Columbia pulling back from this new formula until everybody adjusts to the Common Core, same as in Maryland here, giving it a couple of years. And I thought this was interesting, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yes, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is very much behind the move to Common Core and new tests and new teacher evaluations. And they've sunk a good deal of money into reform of education reform. And they recently came out and said, we believe that schools should hold off for several years until the new tests are in place. And we've seen something, you know, I wonder, though, really, if this isn't as much about the reformers believing that there'll be such a backlash unless we slow down.
Slow down a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, going into the next school year, couple months away, kids, don't worry about it. School doesn't start again until late August, even after Labor Day, maybe. So in the coming year, looking at Common Core's implementation, what do you have your eye on as a reporter for the coming year? What do you expect to be the big stories there?
I think that we'll start to see, well, I think that the big story will be the PARC assessments that will be given a couple times next year.
That's what they called, PARC?
PARCC, which is an acronym. I don't want to remember
okay.
what it is.
But that's what they'll be known as.
That's what they'll be known okay. as. And they're going to be given in a lot of states. And so we'll, for the first time in this nation, be able to compare test scores from different states, for kids from different states.
Hmm.
And that's going to be a big deal. And we also expect, I think that the scores to drop pretty precipitously.
In the first year.
In the first and second years.
Because they're tough.
Way tougher.
You've had a look at the tests and kids taking them.
Yeah, and they're much harder than the current Maryland school assessments.
One last thing. Patrick wanted to know how the school systems are collecting the data. Who's paying for that, this new system on teacher evaluation? Do you know? Is it state funding?
No, it's the normal funding mechanism.
Okay, but it sounds more expensive than just the principal, Mr. Murray, sitting in the back of Miss Venturini's classroom and taking some notes. Not even writing anything down that I remember. I'm sorry. Liz, it's fun having you here.
Thanks.
Very good. Very informative. Always Liz Bowie, a veteran education reporter of the Baltimore Sun, has been our guest in this hour of midday. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you.
And you can take some lunch, because we have lunch for you today. Tuesday lunch provided by Bagby Pizza Company, located in historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. Bagby Pizza Company serving brick oven, thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches, pastas, salads, and more. And they're open daily 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Delivery in the nighttime, 5 to 9 p.m. Stay tuned for the news, and we'll see you for the second hour of our show.